This is a Radio Visions presentation. 21-year-old Bruce Lake was a Marine pilot flying H-46 helicopters in Vietnam from March 1968 till April 1969. He was what they called a frog flyer. What follows is from his book 1500 Feet Over Vietnam, in his own words.
For many years, I was embarrassed or afraid to let others know that I had served in Vietnam. I thought that I wanted to forget all about Vietnam. I knew that I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to remember the details. When a fellow pilot and friend who had been a POW for 4 years was released, I couldn't muster the courage to visit him. Perhaps it was to help hide my past that I let my hair grow long enough to collect in a ponytail, and I grew a full beard and mustache. My motorcycle gave me a chance to get away from it all. By design, most military aircraft are very powerful. That's the way it was with the motorcycle. It was as close to flying as I could get. I could even wear my leather flight jacket and flight boots, as well as the gloves and flight helmet. When one of the rear shock absorbers broke, I left it that way because it was much easier to do wheelies. I never really felt comfortable with the front wheel way off the ground, but the rush of adrenaline felt good. The motorcycle alone didn't prove enough to help me get things sorted out. There was a need to remain apart from the rest of the world to protect myself from the sadness, the pain, and the confusion in my mind about what had gone on in the Vietnam War. Here is my story. I remember I was voted as the most courteous boy in high school. I lived 10 miles away, so I really could not get involved in the sports like I wanted to because I had to take the bus. I was in the band. A lot of the band members were amazed that 1 year I was in the band, and the next year I was flying military aircraft all around the U.S. and flying military aircraft in Vietnam under combat conditions, and they still talk about that.
The Marine Corps sent me a letter and said, "Do you want to fly?" When I got to flight school, I knew that I was going to be able to fly a lot. I turned 21 the day I left Keene, New Hampshire to go to Vietnam, so I was one of the younger pilots. I had started as a cadet in flight school, and I had even told my grandfather that I hoped to fly before I got my driver's license.
We really never knew where we were going to go. When we had our briefing in the morning, we had a general idea of what area we would be flying in, but then we were always diverted depending on how important a mission was.
Contact Gunslinger 2-1,
Flight of 2. Rod Carlson and I prepared to go in to answer some Marine recon units. As we approached the zone, they started firing at us. We called in air support. Some Marine Air Force came in. They prepped the zone by dropping bombs. The amount of time that they could actually spend in the air was 12 to 15 minutes. That's all the fuel that they carry because of the hot temperatures. We were flying at a high altitude to watch where the Marines were going to make sure that the jets were bombing the proper site. When one of the Phantoms pulled out, the bottom of his aircraft was facing our aircraft, and we were at 1,500 feet. He was coming directly at us. Because he couldn't see us, we were trying desperately to get out of the way, and he's in a bank, so he couldn't see us. No matter what we did, we would increase power and turn to the right, we would try to climb, but he was coming at us so quickly, we thought for sure we were going to be in a mid-air collision. pulled into a sharp right bank, and both Rod and I looked out the left side of our cockpit, and all we could see was the panels riveted on the bottom of the F-4. That's how close we were. Both of us were covered in sweat from that experience. Rod Carlson, a real close friend today.
Thank you, Nash. This is High Boy 3, Wife of the Flight Attendant.
When you actually got diverted by the control on ground to a medevac, you might go directly to a jungle area to recover somebody because the Marines were in the field. The Marines knew that in order to get our helicopter in to pick somebody up, we had to have 85-foot clearing because that was the distance from the front of the front blade to the back of the back blade. But you could not clear that big an area in the jungle to recover a Marine if he was injured. So the Marines usually moved the injured man to the bottom of a valley floor or near a river because that would give us enough room to hover to pick somebody up. I flew with Billy Hale on one mission. He later died in a mid-air collision in Vietnam. But we were picking up a Marine that was in the very bottom of a valley. And we hovered as low as we could get between two steep hillsides. And the rotor blades were actually clipping the trees on the side of the valley. That's how steep it was. But we could not get to the river valley floor. So we would drop the hoist cable as much as 100 feet below the aircraft. And the Marine would be put in a stretcher or a harness. And we would pull them up on the hoist and then depart.
Please come down for the northeast.
We got a briefing in the air. My Marine unit was on the ground and was taking a lot of enemy fire and needed to be extracted. We went into this area called Arizona Territory to bring Marines in to support the fellows who were on the ground. And as I was coming in for a landing, a Huey said, "Keep low." The H-46s could spiral into a zone. The Hueys that came along for gun support were in a circle around us, and they could fire down toward the enemy while we were coming down in a tight zone. One of the Hueys came up beside me, and I heard the pilot say, "Keep low." I didn't really understand what he meant. Before I could ask him what he meant, all of a sudden I see the aircraft make a sharp left bank and fire directly in front of us. I heard the rocket as it went by us. And I felt the concussion and wondered what he was doing. He was actually firing at somebody who was going to fire a rocket-propelled grenade at us. What he did was prevent us from getting shot down, because immediately after he fired his rocket, we didn't have any more fire coming at us.
If we had gotten there a fraction of a second sooner, we would have ended up like my friend Ski did a few months later. Every morning when I get up, each new day is a gift.
Those were really busy days for us. We averaged 21 to 24 days of flying combat missions every month. My logbook has black entries in it for administrative flights and red entries for combat flights. And I could count 21 to 24 combat days of flying each month of March through August of 68. With the Korean Marines, we had three designated sites called Ham Salad Alpha, Ham Salad Bravo, Ham Salad Charlie. We also had designated Marine fire bases, and those were sites that were always going to be there. Anwa, Hill 55, different areas where we always landed. When we flew with the Recon Marines, you never knew where you were going to land. You were called at the briefing to point out on the map which of the zones you might go to. And the jungle canopy was three layers. You could not land through that canopy. So the Marines in the briefing would show you areas that were relatively clear. They might be elephant grass at the top of a ridgeline or somewhere where they could land. And you didn't know where it was until the briefing.
Roger, Highboy. Contact Gunslinger 2-1 on Maroon.
Warrant Officer Poe, we called him Gunner, was one of the older pilots. He had flown the F-4U Corsair in the Marine Corps in Korea,
and also flew the A-1 Skyraider for 3 years after that. He had lots of flight hours and was now flying the H-46 helicopter, capable of carrying up to 25 troops. It was always educational when you were assigned to a fly as his co-pilot, because he had more knowledge of the aircraft and more flight hours than anyone I knew. We received radio briefings in the air, and when we got to the landing area, we made a tight diving spiral from 1,500 feet down to the designated landing site. It was really pretty critical to lower the collective just the proper amount. If you lowered it too much, then the spray clutch would release the engines and you wouldn't have any more power to the rotor blades on the engines. The collective is the lever on the left side of the control that actually moves all the blades up and down at the same time. The problem with that was when you are ready to land, you pull in the collective and the engine was idling. It wasn't at full power. So that was pretty critical how you pulled in the power. And the gunner suggested that rather than making a tight spiral over the landing zone, that we ought to try a spiral somewhere else and then come in low and fast and do what they call a button hook into the zone to keep the enemy from learning where we were going to land. And at his suggestion, we pushed the collective down and pushed the cyclic forward and spiraled down about 300 to 400 yards away from the landing site. And this was a Korean zone, or the Republic of Korea Marines. The zone was called Ham Salad Charlie. When we pulled the nose up at a low altitude and flared for landing, we had 12 Marines on board. I heard a real loud pop on the right side of the aircraft. And I'll get goosebumps when I tell you this, because we got shot down on this mission. It was a real bright sunny morning. The sun was just coming over the horizon. And when I heard the pop, I knew right away that someone was firing at us. We had heard before what it sounded like to have people fire at the aircraft on another mission when we were flying and had a single round come right up between the two pilots. The second burst of rounds was 5 or 6 rounds directly behind my head, 15 inches behind my head. And all I remembered was that the inside of the cockpit was full of a red mist. And I looked down and my arm was dripping with red, and I thought for sure that I or somebody had been shot. It turns out that the bullets broke the hydraulic lines that controlled the flight controls that were pressurized to 3,000 PSI. So the hydraulic fluid was spraying in the aircraft. And I temporarily froze on the controls. Again, I thought somebody had been hit in the aircraft. And we managed to bring the aircraft down before we lost all the hydraulic fluid. And it takes 3,000 pounds of pressure to move the rotor system. So it was important that we got down as quickly as possible. We surveyed the damage, and Gunner Poe suggested that I find a radio and request 5 gallons of hydraulic fluid. I always felt comfortable in the air, but this was the first time I was on the ground in a combat situation. As I was leaving the aircraft, I heard mortar rounds exploding, and I started running pretty fast because I was really nervous. I ran to the nearest Korean Marine and indicated that I needed a radio. He said, "Follow me," and I went into the bunker underground, about 3 levels underground, to the command center, and we were able to get a radio to call our wingman. We always traveled in at least a group of 2 aircraft at a time. When we called the wingman, we told him what we needed. Within 90 minutes, Gunner Poe had taken parts from the utility hydraulic system, which controls the hoist and the ramp, and rebuilt the flight control systems, the 2 main systems. We were able to strap the ramp up to keep it from falling down in flight, since it no longer had pressure to hold it up. Apparently, the first pop that I heard was a round that was aimed at the cockpit and missed. It hit the nose wheel just underneath me. And later on, when I looked at the aircraft, I realized that the rounds were definitely fired at me and not at the control closet. Thankfully, we were going fast enough that the rounds hit behind me. Thank you. do remember after all the years some of the funny things that happened, because that's the way our minds protect us, I think.
Bing Emerson was a really special person. He was a direct descendant of Ralph Waldo Emerson. We might have all been sitting around the squadron area after returning from 10 or 12 hours of flying, and we might be reading letters from home, we might be reading a book, and he would come in from a flight and see everybody doing different things in the hooch, and he would collect us all and say, "We're going to read poetry," which was always kind of fun for us, because some of the pilots would resist, but eventually Bing would get us all lined up on a cot, and we'd be sitting there and reading different stanzas of poetry. A lot of the pilots keep a phrase that Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, and it goes like this. We call it success. To laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to know even one life has breathed easier because you lived. This is to have succeeded. Combat missions included medical evacuations. They were emergency evacuations of injured troops. We would resupply troops who needed to go into the field to support men that had been removed because they were injured. We did a lot of resupply of equipment. We had ammunition, water, food, first aid supplies. For emergency missions, we could only carry water, ammunition, and first aid supplies, because we didn't want to carry any extra weight. We gave only essential equipment to them on the emergency missions.
Roger, high boy. We have a resupply from Anwar to the units on Konoi.
Roger that. Contacting Anwar Tower.
In Operation Mead River, George Bunda was one of our pilots who had been assigned temporarily as a resupply officer. He went into the field and made sure that our helicopters were not overloaded, make sure that we had the proper gear. We were going to resupply an area that was in a very, very serious situation. He said, "I don't think the Marines are going to make it through the night unless we can get supplies to them." Every flight that went there could not land. And this was one of the missions where it was classified emergency, so we could only carry water and ammunition and first aid supplies. We wanted to make a fast approach and drop the load and then get out quickly. I also asked the crew if they wanted to go on the mission. They knew that all the previous aircraft were not able to get in that day, and I wanted to make sure that the crew was with them. And the crew members agreed with me that we should do this. The Marines were in an oxbow. The river made a large circular pattern around the area where the Marines were located, and the enemy was so close, our Marines were not able to fire at the enemy without hitting the Marines as well. So we started our approach from 1,500 feet down. It had already turned dark. It was a tight spiral. At 1,000 feet of altitude, I asked the co-pilot to start reading off the altitude to me at 100-foot increments. I also asked him to turn out the lights on the aircraft. Only thing that the enemy could fire at was the sound of our aircraft. And I could no longer see the instrument panel with the lights off. But Larry was looking closely at the altimeter, and I heard him say 900, 800, 700 as we went down. Just as he said 400, I saw the muzzle flash between my feet, and I felt the plexiglass hit my flight suit. As the plexiglass shattered between my feet, I felt the plexiglass move the material on my flight suit. And that was the muzzle flash that I had seen below us. We continued our flight down, and there had been a Marine standing in the zone holding a strobe light so that we could come into the spot where he wanted us to land. And he was holding the strobe light so we could see it, and all of a sudden I saw no strobe light because we had just passed through 400 feet, and I thought, well, maybe he got hit. Maybe he's injured. And then just through the darkness, I could see the silhouette of a tree in front of us. There was a very large tree between where the Marine was standing with the flashlight and where we were. And I knew that we were going to hit the tree unless I dropped the sling load, the cargo net. So we opened the hook on the bottom of the aircraft, dropped the net to the ground, and that gave us enough lift to get over the tree and make our landing. When we landed, we were slightly outside of the zone that we were supposed to land in, and the men on the ground said, "We have three seriously injured Marines. We want you to come, and we want you to stay there until the Marines can be brought on board." And we sat in the landing zone waiting for those Marines and took several hits in the aircraft from small arms fire while we were there. So in many ways, we were sitting ducks. And a lot of times we had to sit in the field and wait while people were brought on board. We probably sat there a minute or a minute and a half. Because all the lights were out, the enemy could only fire at the sound. And I remember people in the air asking if we were going to come out. What they saw from the air was tracer rounds coming in toward us from everywhere. And they thought for sure we would never make it out. Once the Marines were loaded, we just pulled in full power, went straight up as high as we could, nosed the aircraft over, and flew out. When we got back to the base, we realized that we had taken 13 hits in the aircraft, and two of them were through my side of the cockpit while we were sitting there in the zone. And that was the mission where I earned the Silver Star.
Maybe as males in particular, men are taught to be competitive, and all through flight school, we compete with each other, and the idea is to win the game. And I went to Vietnam with the feeling that we needed to win the war. I don't think I'd been there 3 or 4 weeks when I felt we probably would not win the war. There was no front. There was no line that we were advancing. We had a base here. We would have a fire base here. We'd have a landing zone over here. But we didn't advance from those areas. There was no ground to call our own except those little bases. And we were supposed to ask permission to fire back if somebody fired at us. And to me, that wasn't the way to win a war.
And the first time you see bodies and pieces of bodies being brought to your aircraft, that's when I stopped looking outside the aircraft when I'm sitting in the zone. I concentrated on the controls and the instruments and listened to the radios, because it was very difficult seeing what was brought on the aircraft. I blanked it out. The first time I had picked up all that many medevacs and we landed back at the base and I got out of the cockpit and started walking toward the back of the aircraft, I slipped on the blood on the floor. And that's why, from that time on, I'm just looking straight ahead.
If you are able, save for them a place inside of you and one backward glance when you are leaving for the places they can no longer go. Be not ashamed to say you love them, though you may or may not always have. Take what they have left and what they have taught you with their dying, and keep it with your own. And in that time when men decide and feel safe to call the war insane, take one moment to embrace those gentle heroes you left behind.
In a world of whirling wings, ready to rise and soar, I pause to view the past of my brothers before, who proudly formed the Brotherhood, climbing above Asian land. Against aggression they stood, a proud generation who left us an inspiration. Hold our heads high each time take to the sky. We labor long.
Ready one.
Ready outside on one, sir.
Ready two.
Ready two, sir.
Clear to spin.
You're clear outside, sir.
Engaging rotors.
Warriors, for each mission we rise to achieve, reflecting on tradition, keeping to our creed. Rock Lions, with the courage to be on the sea, with our rollers high, we heed the cry.
It was very difficult for me to walk away from those years in the Marine Corps because flying had become such an important part of my life. I enjoyed living life on the very edge. It was easy to convince myself that I was immortal, or nearly so. After all, I had flown hundreds of missions in combat conditions in just 11 months. I survived helicopter crashes and so many near misses and close calls that I couldn't count them. Things are better now. It's been over 40 years since I left Vietnam, and the period of adjustment isn't fully over yet. But I don't for a minute begrudge my service to my country, because I was doing what I wanted to do. I was flying because I wanted to. I went into the Marine Corps because I wanted to, and I went to Vietnam because I wanted to.
Bruce Lake wishes to give special thanks to Rod Carlson, who made a big difference in his life and remains a loyal, supportive friend, Larry, who flew as co-pilot with Bruce when he earned the Silver Star, his parents Robert and Barbara, his grandfather Milton Lake, who encouraged Bruce to follow his dreams to fly, his brother Alan, who also served in Vietnam as a Marine, and his wife Kay and daughter Heather. We want to remember those who passed away: Bing Emerson, Billy Hale, Glenn Zamorski, George Bunda, and Gunnar Poe. The poem Remember Them was written by helicopter pilot Michael Davis O'Donnell just 83 days before he was killed in action. The Frog Flyer Anthem was written by Bill Miller, sung by Amik Byram, produced by Edo Guidotti. The Bruce Lake story was produced and directed by Charles Langdon. This has been a Radio Visions presentation. Lee Shepard speaking.